Webster's Dictionary defines compliance as the action or fact of complying with a wish or command. This is The Compliance Guy.
The Compliance Guy.
As a healthcare provider or healthcare professional, navigating the muddy waters of compliance can get tricky.
And that's why we're here.
Helping you mitigate risk while increasing your profitability. This is The Compliance Guy. Now, here's your host, Sean Weiss.
All right. Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of The Compliance Guy. I'm Sean Weiss. And as always, I want to begin by saying thank you all so much for tuning in, logging on, and just hanging out with me for a little while. As you all know, we have moved our show over to the Anchor platform, which is Spotify, and we couldn't be happier. So with that said, today, this is a topic, and this is a special guest for me that is so critical. It's so important. As some of you know, I've talked about it in the past when behavioral health has been a topic on our program. Behavioral health is so important to me. I had a brother in 2003 who was lost to suicide, and I believe in my heart of hearts, had we had the technology, had we had providers who were available via telemedicine to take away the stigma of having to go to a medical office for those who had phobias of leaving the house or phobias of being seen by other people, or for whatever the reason was, in my heart of hearts, I still believe my brother would be here today. And over the years, you all know I've done a lot of work with the American Psychiatric Association. I've lectured for pharmaceutical companies, for behavioral health medications to help providers be more aware. So today I have an absolute pleasure of introducing my listeners to Dr. Marlene Mayhew, who's a PhD. And she started an organization called TBHI, which is the Telebehavioral Health Institute. And they have an incredible mission. And it's very simple, which is to deliver high-quality, evidence-based professional training to healthcare providers in the behavioral health space worldwide. In getting to know Dr. Mayhew, obviously, I spent a lot of time looking at things like her newsletter, looking at the published papers that she has. And she's just such a fascinating person. I can't wait for you to really understand who she is. But just real quickly, to give you a little bit of a background, Dr. Mayhew has published 43 book chapters and journal articles, as well as 5 professional books related to telehealth practice. She's a consultant, a researcher, an author, a trainer, and she's served more than 55,000 professionals all across the country in more than 100 countries. So it's fair to say this is one of the leading and foremost experts in telehealth when it comes to behavioral health services. And I think one of the things that is so key to keep in mind for you as our listeners is that telehealth has really been pushed to the forefront as part of the public health emergency. And 89% of patients have now, under CMS, have now received telehealth services, and they have said it's convenient, they like it, they like the format, they like the accessibility, they like that they don't have to travel, they don't have to wait, they have a dedicated time slot, and they're going to continue to use it. But with that, on the regulatory side and the health law side, as you all know, it's become a huge audit target because there are so many bad actors out there. And there's a difference between telehealth, telemedicine, and telefraud. But I'm not going to get into all that today because I really want to talk with Dr. Mayhew. I want you all to get an opportunity to hear directly from her about what she's doing, why she's doing it, and where she sees the future of telehealth in behavioral health medicine going. So with that said, Dr. Mayhew, thank you so much for carving time out of your busy day. It's great to see you. Thank you for being here, and I'm excited to have this conversation with you.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yes, ma'am. So why don't we go ahead and get started? Because I know you, you do so much training and education all around the world. But really, if we can first start off by focusing, really what you see going on here in the United States with telehealth and behavioral health services and the patterns, trends, and where you, you know, where you see this thing actually going.
There's a lot going on, and the biggest bottleneck we've had for telemedicine rollout and telehealth rollout in this country is clinician adoption. So many consumers have wanted it because it is convenient, and we all know convenience sells in our country. So if I don't have to go to an office, be it a physician's office or a therapist's office, I don't have to park my car and sit there and wait for the person to come out, but rather someone can just come right to me when it's ready to, when they're ready to start. Even if they're running late, I don't have to sit there. So that is a big savings for people. And with telehealth, when you get into the behavioral world, there's a lot of stigma still. So my generation, certainly there's a lot of stigma, and younger people are getting more and more on board with it. There's less stigma, but you know, it's kind of an interesting thing. There's less stigma if you don't have serious mental illness. But nobody wants serious mental illness. There's a lot of job opportunities that might get lost, a lot of relationship problems get caused, and so people don't really want to admit to that. And that's why the government actually changed the term in all the federal documents. So it's now called behavioral health, and it includes addiction, which was always sort of on the side. But what happened in our country, because of the stigma, was there were two systems that were developed. So we had medical care on one side and we had behavioral health care on the other. And the buildings were different, the staff was different, and the insurance companies were different, and the insurance companies had different caps on it. So they would not require that insurance company give the same cap. So you may have $1 million for a lifetime cap for medical care, but you know, for behavioral it was $100,000. Though then in 2011 they forced a merging. So the federal government required parity. So now we've got that combined. But the systems are still different. The buildings are different, people are trained differently, and the only crossover is when you need medication. But most people don't need medication for behavioral health care. They need to talk it out, and they don't have the family systems that we used to have to be able to talk it out.
I think that's such an interesting point that you made, because you bring up the point about medications, right? And obviously a lot of folks, you know, they, you know, with Dr. Google, as I call it, you know, people going out and they read all of this information about potential side effects of medication, or they know somebody who was on you know, an antidepressant or an antipsychotic or whatever the medication may be, and they hear about how it affected them, you know, mentally, how it affected them socially, how it affected them, you know, in their intimacy with their loved one or their partner. But to hear you say in behavioral health that the majority of people just need to be able to talk it out, as opposed to having... Now, obviously, with major, you know, depressive disorders and other psychological behavioral disorders, medication's obviously a significant part of it. But, you know, for those who are dealing with, you know, borderline depression or dealing with anxiety or whatever it may be, you're saying that having that conversation with a healthcare professional is providing or yielding more significant beneficial outcomes for the patients? Am I understanding that correctly?
Yeah, I think you could look at the analogy of someone that needs physical therapy, okay? And let's say you break a leg, okay? And you're laid up and it doesn't go well, so you're laid up even longer, so that, you know, months and months roll on, you have a cast, now you started to alter your gait. At some point that cast will come off and you will need to go to physical therapy if you want to get professional help. Okay, some people just limp around for the rest of their lives, but this is true in the emotional sense too. But back in the original way that the human species has evolved, all right, the people around you knew you your whole life. They knew, for example, that your father was killed in a car accident when you were three, and you've got, you know, three uncles that stepped in and helped parent you, and, you know, and father. I mean, there's all kinds of things that happened that now we don't have in general in the United States. So people now have specialized more and more, and they do have a skill set that you just won't get in your neighbor or your uncle. So they're more specialized, like a physical therapist would be. So this does not require medication. You may need medication if for a while, but if you look at the population of clinicians, it's 1% to 5% of the people are prescribers in the behavioral health world. Psychiatry, and there are also prescription writing psychologists or nurse practitioners, they're 2% to 5%. That's very small. All the rest of the people do talk therapy, and most people don't need medication. And so there's it's too bad there's just not enough information has gotten out about that. But when we bring it to telehealth, it's quite obvious. The behavioral world has been the leader for telehealth for decades. When you look at the Medicare system, CMS, the last audit that we were able to find and cite said that we even have a blog post on this on our site, 85.4%, I believe, 4 of 6% of all Medicare claims related to telehealth included a behavioral diagnosis. And all the rest, the cardiology, the pulmonology, the dermatology, all of that, all those diagnoses were the rest of it. So it's 14 point whatever it would be. That's amazing when you look at the numbers on this. Now, with the pandemic, of course, most therapists that wanted to survive financially and wanted to serve their practices went online. And now, because of all the stress and uprooting that the pandemic has caused with all the isolation, it's been even more of a demand for behavioral services.
Yeah, and that doesn't surprise me. I mean, day in and day out, you can see published study after published study about the impacts of the isolation from the public health emergency, the impact of children, having to wear masks day in and day out, not being able to see the facial expressions of the adults in their education, lives, seeing the facial expressions of the other children that are in their classes, having to social distance, all of these things have obviously, created a significant change. Now, for how long that change lasts is yet to be seen, because obviously at some point the public health emergency is going to come to an end. Children will be able to hopefully go back to pre-pandemic ways of engaging with each other. But until then, there's, I have 5 grandbabies, and for me, it's been really interesting for my two oldest, the 11-year-old and the soon-to-be 8-year-old, to watch how their social skills, their interaction, their mannerisms, how all of those things have changed, and changed pretty significantly during the public health emergency, because here in Georgia, there was only a short period of time before they were able to go back to school. It may have been 6 weeks. But, I am interested to see the continued evolution of telehealth in behavioral health services. And I think, removing that stigma by calling it behavioral health services as opposed to psychiatric care,
right,
was a huge influence in that. So a couple of things, in going through your blogs and looking at some of the different posts that you have, one of the first questions that I think my listeners, because I have a lot of physicians and a lot of managers that listen to the podcast, they're going to ask, okay, how do I create a HIPAA compliant site? How do I know that I'm providing a secure site, something that's not going to violate either the privacy rule or the security rule? What can you talk about as far as those organizations wanting to create that secure website?
I think the tools today don't all center around a website. Most of the time, if just look in the medical world, there's a physician site, and you can go read about the physician. But if you want to interact with that physician, it's a portal. and you go into another place. Now, they may have links on the physician site or the teletherapy site, teletherapist site that goes to the portal. For some people, it'll pop up in on their screen, the professional screen in their calendars, but then you can just click right into a video room like we clicked in to come into this room. It's a link, and you click in, and there you are. Okay, so that is something that can include other communication channels like texting. It is illegal to use a cell phone, what's prepackaged into a cell phone, iMessage if you have a Mac, an iOS system, but if you know, Android is different, but it's illegal to use it because it's not HIPAA compliant. So whatever you do, you've got to make sure that you have a HIPAA compliant channel for every single thing you do. Cloud storage, it's not necessarily HIPAA compliant. Out of the box, it's not HIPAA compliant. So the way to tell is that you get a business associate agreement. If a company will give you a BAA, a business associate agreement, then you can trust that they are HIPAA compliant. And that's not just for one thing and then you go email people out of your Gmail box, your Hotmail box or something. No, every single communication you have with your client or your patient needs to be HIPAA compliant. And the way you tell is you get a certificate from that particular service. So if it's email, you need a HIPAA compliant email. There's a safe harbor out of it. But if you want to use non-HIPAA compliant email, then you need to have that be part of your informed consent. And informed consent, by the way, is not a screen with a bunch of words on it that says, I agree at the bottom, and your client looks at that, zips down to the bottom, hits, I agree. No, no, no. Informed consent in the behavioral world means that the clinician had a discussion. Try to do that in text messaging, okay? But they had a discussion that leaves the clinician reasonably assured that the client or the patient knows what's going to happen and they agree to it. And that's pretty tough to do if you're not going to be talking to them and seeing them, listening to their voice, answering their questions. So you need to do all of that for email and say, look, bad things can happen in email, can go to the wrong person. You can send whatever you're trying to send to me, you can send it by mistake to, you know, your ex-husband or whatever, you know. So you've got to warn them this kind of thing can happen. And then if they agree, then you're good.
That's right. That's right. And HIPAA is becoming more and more a significant player in the world of regulatory compliance, because, you know, for years we didn't really have, if you would, a HIPAA police force, right? There was no, the laws have been on the books since 1996, but the enforcement was what was really lagging behind. But in last couple of years, the enforcement on HIPAA has become significant, especially with all of the breaches that have taken place, the hacking by outside entities, these cyber terrorist organizations who are taking hostage, you know, protected health information of, you know, significant medical centers, hospitals, health, you know, systems. But I want to go back just for a moment, because I think you made some great points on the evolution or where we're at as far as the billing. So one of your blogs that you posted in July of 2022, I think it was on July 13th, I was reading. Let me see if I can find it here. Okay. So there was some really interesting numbers in here, and I want to expand on this a little bit. So it says, quote, as expected, between March of 2019 and March of 2020, telehealth claim lines as a percentage of total claims increased by 4,347%. And in April, it increased by 8,336%. The top five diagnoses in the spring of 2020 differed considerably from prior years, and codes now included consultations for hypertension, development disorders, diabetes, whereas previously they centered largely around patient education, self-care, evaluation, and management encounters. I mean, those statistics mm-hmm. are telling, right? I mean, so this is speaking into why telehealth has, is, and will continue to be such a significant, you know, provide such a significant impact in the healthcare industry.
Well, I think if you're looking for indicators of what's going to happen in the future, all right, here's one source to look at, and that's called reimbursement. Okay, where's the reimbursement going? And I, in my training clinicians, most clinicians don't understand the system, but Medicare is it. Okay, it's the gorilla. And if you look at what Medicare has done for behavioral health care, it has permanently, and that means permanently approved video and audio, telephone only care, you see, for behavioral diagnoses. Okay, so what's the future of telehealth for behavioral? Well, Medicare's going to pay for it. And when Medicare pays for anything, first off, the evidence base behind that is a mile high because they don't pay for anything extra, okay? If this thing doesn't work, they're not going to pay for it, period. So they have now permanently agreed to pay for certain diagnoses, which then clinicians, you know, we all have to eat, will go do those services, and that's why they do that. That's why they pay, so that our care will improve according to the evidence base. All right? Now, there are many people that say, yeah, but I want to work for a private insurance company. Well, the issue there is they get to make up their own rules. You see, they say, I'm going to pay for these things, and telehealth may or may not be included. Well, if you want to work for them, then you're not going to get paid to do the telehealth. But as an entity, you can decide who you want to work for. Now, one of the other things that Medicare is also paying for increasingly is remote patient monitoring. I was just writing an article this morning before I came in here about remote patient monitoring and other ways that behavioral clinicians can be paid for telehealth work. So it includes the active talking to somebody on video or by telephone, although it's much more complex. Working with serious mental illness is much more complex when you're doing it through telephone. Obviously, you can't see the person, right? There could be 15 people in their room influencing them. They could be lying to you about where they are. You know, there's all kinds of stuff can go on. But basically, the video and then all the other media. So remote patient monitoring, like I'm wearing a ring right now that measures my sleep quality, my heart rate variability. It gives me a daily reading of how many minutes I spent in each of the four stages of sleep, all right? And then it gives me an overall indicator of what is, you know, what my overall score is today. Should I really go do a hard workout, or should I just kind of, you know, chill a little bit on that extra 15 minutes in my workout? You see, that kind of thing.
So is that like,
you know, it is biofeedback because you see, remote patient monitoring devices include these attachments that you can have to your body. Okay, it can come in the form of a necklace. Okay. I'm sorry, I'm blocking on the term, but the heart rate variability is biofeedback. Okay. It's the updated version of that. And you, if you look at a Fitbit, you look at an Apple Watch, all of these devices are going there, in which case what they will be doing, because I know this because I talk to the vendors a lot, all right, is it's already exists. They're looking at autonomic nervous system responsivity, okay? And what we're looking at there is resilience, because there's a sine wave that gets produced when you're doing heart rate variability equations, all right? And it's the ratio between your cardiac and your pulmonary functioning. And you can train yourself using biofeedback, but, you know, modern day biofeedback, heart rate variability, to control that sine wave. You see, so you can calm your insides down, basically. So it's in essence what meditation will do, but now you've got a device that will give you feedback, you know, moment to moment to moment, to tell you how to. That's next generation. That's what's coming, and that the behavioral clinicians will have access to in very short order. Now, where the data goes for that, Sean, that's the compliance issue. Okay. And that's where clinicians are required to be very careful about this, because it's easy to get sucked into something like this because it's exciting. If you're like me, you're an early adopter. I've been doing this 29 years. You see, I'm an early adopter. But if you're like me, then you've got to chill out a little bit and make sure that whatever you offer has gotten the approval from the for HIPAA, but also the Federal Trade Commission. You know, if it's a diagnosis, it's the Federal Drug Administration. You know, if it involves diagnosis and treatment, it's an FDA approved, and they're not quite there for behavioral.
Yeah, I was always, so I have a smartwatch that I use, and, you know, I like this one. It was created for the military, and I like it, and it has some of the things that you were talking about for a biofeedback, right? So at any point, I could measure my heart rate. It has my sleep, you know, for like how many hours of REM, deep sleep, light sleep. Yeah, and then it measures your blood oxygen. I've always wondered how accurate these things really are, because I have one that actually, you know, if I put my finger on it here, right, and I leave my finger and I sit very quietly, it will actually do an EKG and it will produce like a rhythm strip. Now, it says, hey, pay attention. You know, we can't tell you if you're having a heart attack, but we could tell you if there's like some abnormalities in your ST waves or if you're showing signs of atrial fibrillation. I've always wondered
if
how
it doesn't have
what are your thoughts?
Approval from the Federal Drug Administration, okay, which is healthcare, right? It is not something that you should rely on for some life-threatening possibility, okay? And that's why I said earlier, for behavioral, they're not quite there. But it's coming, folks. I don't know how long it'll take, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years. That has to do with the budgets, right? And because when they get these approvals, it costs a lot of money to get the approvals. There are trials, you know, and there's a lot involved. It takes years to get these approvals, but they have it for diabetes. So it's disorder specific. Diabetes FDA approved devices like this, remote patient monitoring devices, have been approved for over a decade, right?
Yeah. So staying on the topic of the telehealth, obviously, because that's what this whole segment is about. Can you help explain the difference between synchronous telehealth?
Well, yeah, sure. So synchronous is what we're doing now. We're talking in real time. You ask a question, I answer it. We go back and forth. Okay. Asynchronous is what we were talking about a few minutes ago. So that you're looking at a device, all right, and maybe that device is connected to a patient portal at your clinician's office, and they can see what's going on with you, although you have to realize they're not going to see every single little sine wave on that. They're not going to read all that. They have, you know, they can, if they look at your notes about you from the last session, you're lucky, okay? Because people are, you know, clinicians are moving quickly these days. But they should. They should be looking at notes. The thing is, they're not going to look at every single little detail and every single little factor related to you. These systems, when they do get approved, will highlight, there's an abnormality here. Yikes, this guy needs to be called. You know, I need to get someone in my office to call Sean to tell him, you know, do this or that, go to the hospital or something. So it'll be that kind of thing in the future, and that would be more a combination of what we're talking about. They see it, then they call you. Well, that's not real time. It's right. Sequential, right? There's momentary gaps there, right? Or it could be days or weeks before they, you know, that something happens in a patient portal.
You know what's always been amazing to me is how slow we are here in the United States in the medical community.
With what? I didn't catch that.
Technology. So how slow we have been here in the United States with the adoption of technology.
It's really not that complicated.
It's mind-boggling to me for physicians. For physicians, though, right? Because I think about electronic medical records and the slow trudge, even today, the problems that exist with providers using electronic medical records, but just the slow trudge to adoption of technology. Well,
the reason for that in the United States is twofold, okay? One, we have a multi-payer system, all right? And it's state by state. And these state laws are so tight that if you look at any of the big insurance companies, they are required to have a, let's say, Blue Cross, Blue Cross of California, Blue Cross of Nevada, Blue Cross. They can't, the insurance industry can't even penetrate the state by state by state rules. And anybody who tries to borrow any significant amount of money in this country knows insurance companies hold the money in this country. And the and they have a huge lobby, all right? But they can't penetrate it. So if a company were to roll something out, they've got to get Blue Cross, all of these 50 companies for even one type of insurance to adopt it. Whereas if you look at Great Britain, Australia, New Zealand, these are single-payer countries. And I've known tech companies that say, forget the United States. I'm going to these single-payer companies to roll my thing out. And then in 10 years, we'll come back to the U.S. and we'll adopt it there. Okay? So without the reimbursement from insurance, what are clinicians? They're trying to eat too, right? So we get back to what we were talking about before. It's just not going to happen, you see?
You know, so that drives me to another area that I wanted to focus on, because to me this is also a critical area for me as a grandparent. You know, pediatrics. What are you seeing as their approach or any new approaches to diagnosing and treating pediatric mental health or behavioral health issues?
There has been an explosion of research in all areas because of the pandemic related to telehealth. Okay, because I was shocked. You know, I've been publishing since 1997. It's my first book that I published. And then I've done all these journal articles and book chapters and all. I mean, it was slow. It could take 2 years. It could take a year to get something published. You'd send it into the publisher, and, you know, it would take forever. But now these things have been coming out, and I think a lot of researchers that then had the interest, they had the focus on telehealth. And so there are a ton of things, and there's a tremendous demand for training on that. So we have two programs. We did an autism program, pediatric autism program, in March of this year, and I was shocked at the number of signups that we had. And we're getting commercial funding for a lot of these trainings that we offer, so outside funding where it's paid ahead of time and clinicians can come in for free. So, of course, you know, that works well with clinicians. But, you know, there's a tremendous amount of demand for it, and we're rolling one out, another one coming out soon, too. So there's a trauma-informed pediatric telehealth care is what we're rolling out shortly. So there's a lot out there, but clinicians don't necessarily know where to go find it. See, that's the problem.
And that's why I wanted to have you on this program, because I agree with you. I think part of the problem is clinicians don't know where to go to get this education, to go, you know, where do I go to get more information, not only on what's available, but how do I get access to this? And how do I, you know, meet the regulatory requirements? How do I ensure legal, hoops that have to be jumped through in order to be able to provide these services? How do I get reimbursed for these types of services? So that's why I thought it was so important to have you on the program, and I'm so glad that I did. You know, I know one of the other areas that we started talking about, and maybe this, you know, I'll have this as one of my last topics. And if you have anything beyond what we've been talking about that you want to get into, absolutely, let's do that. But you had a blog post that I found to be very interesting, which was, you know, the Office on National Drug Policy, which had to do with telehealth prescribing for substance use disorders. Obviously, the pandemic shined a light on just how significant substance abuse disorders are. And it may have even magnified the amount of substance abuse that takes place in the United States, because more and more people were now alienated. They were forced to work from home. They weren't used to this telecommuting, all these, whatever it is. Can you talk about the impact that telehealth has and will have on substance abuse disorders and teleprescribing for substance abuse?
The world of addictions is quite complicated, but the issue of, let's say, opioid disorders have been so highlighted since 2018 that the federal government declared an epidemic, a national emergency, which those two words triggers the release of millions and millions and millions of dollars. All right, so there was an epidemic, a national emergency declared for opioid use disorder, okay, and that was 2018. The pandemic was on top of it. So the pandemic was a national emergency that was declared in March of 2019, a year later. Okay. And what's happened is that the first national emergency is still raging because of the pandemic as well. So there were efforts that were made to try to come in and address this. But then with the pandemic, well, the problem grew even more. All right. So the isolation caused people to they don't really know where to go. And part of the problem that I see in the country, and actually this is worldwide, with younger generations is I was, for example, raised in a community. We're French-Canadian in my culture, so it was French-Canadian community in Connecticut. And so there were a lot of people that I would go to school that was more of a French-Canadian, cultural school, and then high school and all of that. We were a very tight group. I had a lot of people to talk to. Even at that, I had secrets, you see. And there's a saying, as you are as sick as your secrets, because if you could release your secrets, you will be set free internally, and a lot of your anxieties will dissipate. And that's where, when we lived in family systems where there were many people that knew you, knew your whole life, they knew what happened here and there, and they know somebody else's that was a resource for you, people were not so secretive. In our country, we are extremely secretive, okay? And if you look at what happens with these younger generations, is they're not used to sitting and talking. I've seen people, I go to the gym, I've seen three young people standing together, and I thought, oh, well, that's nice to see young people talking. They were all three of them. They were standing within a few feet of each other, looking down on their cell phones and texting, all in a little. I'm thinking, these kids do not know, young people do not know how to talk the way older people did. And they don't realize that in the talking, you get to somebody else who's listening and reflecting back. You get to know yourself, okay? Relationships means you relate, right? Relating means you connect. And you can't do that if you don't take the time to communicate. So these abbreviated communications are a way that we're stunting our ability to relate to each other. So that, of course, drives more and more anxiety, more and more overwhelm, where I've got to smoke pot because I've got anxiety. Well, you know what? When I was a kid, you have anxiety, too bad. You get kicked out the door. You go do it anyway. And you learn how to overcome your anxiety, unless you have a serious internal disorder, okay, where there's an imbalance. But there's a lot more that we were required to do than the kids are today. So they're more fragile, okay? They're more fragile. They're less apt to communicate when they have anxiety. And when they go for help, they get these systems where they get text therapy. Well, there again, you don't get to hear the voice inflection as the therapist. You don't get to hear the nuance of the stuttering. Why did you stutter there? Because as a therapist, that's what we picked up on. You see, what was the hesitancy? Because that hesitancy is the key that unlocks the secret that will set you free. And I've had people come to me, I did 35 years of practice. I've had people come to me and say, I can't believe I told you my secret. And in my head, I'm thinking, what was I, you know, for me, I'm used to hearing all kinds of things. What did you tell me? In my head, I'm not going to say that to them, but I let them talk. And then eventually it comes out. I had never told anybody that in my whole life, as if this is this horrible thing. And really, you know, we all have a million of those. What's the deal? But in their mind, it was huge, you see, and it caused a tremendous amount of anxiety. So, and depression. Right. So because they feel less than and they can't get over it. So there's a lot of stuff that's going on that people are not able to communicate fully with people who understand them. It takes time to build a kind of relationship with a therapist. So there's a lot of issues involved with telehealth.
Yeah, and, you know, as I'm sitting here listening to, you know, going through this explanation, and it's just brilliant. I relate to it again because I have a grandchild who is on the spectrum. And what I have noticed is that when she was actually in therapy, you know, for her, you know, her autism, and she's not fully diagnosed as autistic. Mm-hmm. It's sensory disorder, but she's, you know, to me, I watch her and I see, you know, she's so high functioning and she's so advanced for a child of her age. And I often have questioned if it's Asperger's, you know, versus, you know, which I know is a form of autism, but if I'm correct. And I've noticed that since she has not been able to go to the therapist, and they've tried to do these camera things, right? The texting, some of the things that you're talking about, where it's that asynchronous, right? She's not responding in the same way that she did when she was either face-to-face with the therapist, or she was like what you and I are doing right now, which is the synchronous. And I'm so glad because I got so much out of today's conversation with you on a personal level. So I know that sounds kind of selfish on my part because I have so many takeaways. But let me ask you in the last couple of minutes, because I do want to drive our behavioral health specialists to your website. You know, more and more family practitioners, internists, primary care physicians, they're having to engage in behavioral health care. They're diagnosing a lot of their patients with depression or anxiety or whatever it may be. I want folks to be able to go to www.telehealth.org, which is TBHI, which is the Telebehavioral Health Institute main website. And you'll see on there, their statistics for subscribers has gained more than 500,000 subscribers to their newsletter, more than 20,000 digital learners, live audience members is approaching 59,000. I mean, the numbers are brilliant. They're outstanding. Congratulations to you, Dr. Mayhew. But let me ask you, in the last couple of minutes, in closing out for our audience, what could you give us some key takeaways? If you had just a few that you could give to our listeners about how to engage in telehealth and where you see this going and why.
Well, depending on who the listener is, if they are people in a position to refer somebody, I would encourage them to do that and do it repeatedly and make it something that's brought up every single time there's a patient contact. All right. And just don't couch it in, hey, you need mental health care, you know, this is a mental health issue, but rather go talk to somebody. Just I don't have the time to sit in many physicians, they don't have the time to sit and talk, right? But they're trained people that can help you. So just go talk to somebody, give it a try. Just give it a try. And try the real talking part as opposed to texting, because you will know yourself more in doing that than if you're just texting, because you leave a lot out of text, you know, and in many ways texting is helpful, because you can leave all that stuff out. You don't have to go to, hi, how are you, blah, blah, blah. You know, you just go right to, hey, I need this, you know. So you can short circuit. But when it comes to knowing yourself, there's no shortcut there, all right? We've already been shortcutted too much. So get people to go talk to folks, all right? And the telehealth, go to a clinician who's trained in telehealth. There are a lot of people who tell you they've been trained in telehealth, but they took 3 hours. Well, hey, if you're going to trust your psyche to somebody, make sure that they have at least 15, 20, 30, you know, 50 hours of training. And you can straight up ask them that, how much formal training have you had? I don't care about the 10 years that you're doing all kinds of doohickey things, okay, on the internet. But how much formal training do you have and from where? You know, so is this a program that people have developed over time? What about the lead trainer? Do they have publications? There are lots of trainers that lots of people can do telehealth. They don't have the publications that I have, or the speaking experience of handling professional audience questions. Of, come on, give me whatever you got. I'll take it. You know, and I can point you if I don't know something. But for the most part, I can pretty much answer stuff. So you know, make sure that your clinician has the right skill set for doing telehealth, because, and this is one of the keys I'm going to ask you to walk away with, any 12-year-old can drive a car, okay, if their legs are long enough. Any 12-year-old can drive a car. But do you want to trust them with your whole family in the back seat there? All right? No, because they've not been trained in how to handle emergencies, you know, what to do with the speed sign. Do I really follow that now? Do I have to? All these decisions, and people who haven't been trained, just they haven't had driver's ed, you see? So you need some driver's ed with all of this.
Such great takeaway points for everybody. Folks, this is going to bring us to the conclusion of the Compliance Guide today. I want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in, logging on, and hanging out with us. And again, thank you so much for making us number 6 on the top 25 out of more than 2,600 podcasts on regulatory compliance and health law. Thank you so much for continuing to tune in and hang out with us. And also, to all of you who have nominated the Compliance Guy podcast and who have actually voted for us on the People's Choice Awards, we should be getting the results in the next few days to the next week. So thank you all so much. Stay tuned. We'll let you know if we won anything. But even if we didn't, it was just such an honor to be nominated and to know that y'all thought so much about this program to take those steps. Again, I want to thank Dr. Marlene Mayhew. She's the Executive Director of the Telebehavioral Health Institute. Again, please check out her organization and the incredible things that she and her team are doing. And you can find them online at www.telehealth.org.
My pleasure,
again, Dr.
Sean.
Mayhew,
thank you.
Thank you so much for being here today. All right, and until tomorrow, folks, remember, be good to yourself, but more importantly, be good to each other.
You've been listening to The Compliance Guy. Sean has been doing this for 28 years. He holds 10 national board certifications. He's a partner and the vice president of compliance for Doctors Management, LLC. He's a subject matter expert in federal court. He's lectured at the most prestigious institutions. He's engaged with members of Congress in both chambers. So what we're saying is he's qualified? We hope you've enjoyed the show. Make sure to like, rate, and review. And we'll be back soon. But in the meantime, you can find us on social media @The Compliance Guy. See you next time on The Compliance Guy.